This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Is there a library, a bookstore around here where I get books on
rock and roll?
Rock and roll.
Story's true.
Well, have you read this one?
Yes. Read my book?
This is a story that needs to be told.
We need rock and rollers to have something to read.
Shh. Quiet, please.
Hey, folks. Christian Sween here. I'd like to talk a bit about our project and about you. The Rock and Roll Archaeology Project is currently 4 podcasts. Our main show, we think of it as a Rock and Roll 101. We will eventually do about 30 of these scripted, carefully researched audio documentaries. And we have the Rock and Roll Librarian, where Shelley Sorensen and I have lively, fun discussions about books that rock. The discussions continue with Rock Talk, a weekly survey of rock and roll news with my co-host, Peter Farioli. And we just rolled out Deeper Digs in Rock, single-topic shows, interviews, and field trips. All we want to do now is more of it, more often. And that's where you come in. Our shows will always be free. That's our promise to you. If you truly enjoy it, if you can't wait for that next episode, well, won't you please make a modest monthly donation via Patreon? Just click the Patreon link right at the top of our webpage, rockandrollarchaeology.com, and take it from there. Thank you, and keep up the rockin'. Everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Rock and Roll Librarian. With me, as always, well, probably about once a month, is, yes, the Rock and Roll Librarian herself, all the way from the San Francisco Public Library, Shelley Sorensen. How Woo-hoo. You doing, Shelley?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty darn good. Yeah. We're going to do this in the evening, which means we get to drink a little bit here.
Yes, sir.
So hopefully we're not sloshing our words here by the end.
This is my after work beer, people.
After
so
work.
I deserve it.
Yes, yes. It's Miller time, isn't it?
Well, not Miller time.
Yes. Oh, you're too cool for that, huh?
Yes. Way too cool.
Anyway, hey, you know what we did this time? We started with a song, which was to clue those in the know about the book that we're going to talk about today. What was the song? And what are we going to dive into, Shelley?
Well, the song is Testimony. And it is also the title of the book that I read by Robbie Robertson about
yes, Mr.
his life
Robertson.
And especially his career with the band named The Band.
Yes, The Band. And we'll get into why they're called The Band.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Like when I tell people I'm reading a book about Robbie Robertson, especially if they're quite a bit younger than me, which more and more people are these days.
yeah,
they're like
happens
The
to
Band,
all
you know, very quizzical, like, who,
which
what?
Band?
What band? Who are you talking about?
So yeah.
He turns into an Abbott and Costello
routine.
I was going to say
right.
an
Who's
Elvis Costello
first,
routine.
Right. Who's yeah. on first? Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. I can remember the first time somebody was trying to tell me about the band, and I'm like going, and their name is?
I know.
Yeah. So Robbie Robertson has finally written his, is it autobiography?
Yep. Yeah, he wrote the book. And
No ghostwriter? Just Robbie himself?
It doesn't seem to be a ghostwriter.
Wow.
You
For
can
a
imagine.
Canadian?
He's a
That's
pretty
amazing.
Good writer.
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
so he's a good writer.
He's
the librarian
a good writer.
Says he's a good writer.
Yeah,
so
and he
his punctuation is probably, and spelling is top notch, right? Yeah.
Well, that's that's just part of writing.
Of course.
He's a good writer, and actually says that he has some kind of uncanny memory that he's inherited from his ancestors. So, which he would have to write this book, because there is a lot of detail and a lot of really, really good stories in it. It was really hard to kind of choose the ones I wanted to talk about, because...
Yeah, it's a big book, right?
Yeah, so many amazing stories. And, you know, he met so many, you know, musicians and interesting people over the years, of course. And
well, so anybody who's seen The Last Waltz, probably the greatest rock and roll concert film ever, you know, all of the guests, you know, is a big draw to that. And The Last Waltz just passed its 40th anniversary here last November.
That's right.
And yeah, it was recorded, about 10 minutes away from where we're at right now.
That's right. Yeah. And I saw this great band.
The old Winterlands, Bill Graham place.
I saw a band a few weeks ago called Midnight North, who did basically half of their set was covers of the band music. That was really,
A
really great concert. It was at Great American Music Hall.
Oh, really? So yeah, a tribute to the band.
Yep.
Very cool.
Yeah. Ah. Really great harmonies.
Well, let's get into it. Let's talk about Robbie's life and all of those rock and roll stories.
Yep.
I know that he started off very young, and is out of Toronto. I know he's Canadian. Is that right? He's out of Toronto?
That's right. Yeah. He was born in 1943, and his mother, Dolly, who I may still be alive, I'm not sure, she is or was a Mohawk Indian, and she married a white man who was Robbie's father, at least who he thought was his father for the first 13 years of his life. And his given name is Jamie. Many people don't know that. Jamie Robertson, named after his dad, James.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up in a very diverse neighborhood in Toronto, but spent time on the Indian Reserve as well, and had, you know, many relatives that he visited there a few times a year, and loved the freedom of being a kid on the reserve. And he also, his Indian relatives played music also, so he came by his craft very honestly. But he also, of course, took guitar lessons as a boy, and got an electric guitar at a certain point, and was in Toronto when rock and roll hit really hard. So he got to see a lot of great music in Toronto, and see the traveling shows come through, Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Elvis Presley, and, you know, all the late 1950s, exciting stars.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So, and then I believe he hooks up with Ronnie Hawkins when he's like 16 years old. Is that right?
Yeah, he was in a little band called the Swades at the time when he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And they opened for Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks.
Okay.
At the time, Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks played very primitive rock and roll, rockabilly. And he was a real showman, a real, you know, powerhouse ladies' man, and had, you know, people in his band that
a big
wanted
personality,
to put on,
we might
yeah,
say.
A good show, a
right.
good show. And so he hung out to watch the Hawks and just kind of tried to just hang out with them and see what they were doing and make himself useful and be kind of an apprentice when he was about 14
Smart,
or 15.
Right.
Yeah. By the time he was 16, Ronnie Hawkins said, "Hey, you know, why don't you come down to Arkansas and audition for the band? We need a new guitar player." Well, he had to talk his mother into that. Of course, he's 16 and he's going to take the train from Toronto all the way down to Fayetteville, Arkansas. And somehow he convinced her that this was his dream, and she allowed him to do it.
Wow.
What a mom.
Yeah. Very cool mom.
Yeah.
Would you do that?
Well, if my kids had a passion and a drive, I might. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, moms out there, take a listen. All right. Hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to play a little bit of Ronnie Hawkins so people know where that comes from. And like you said, that primitive rock and roll, we're going to do Who Do You Love?
walk 47 miles of barbed wire. Use a cobra snake for a necktie. Got a brand new house on the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. Got a brand new chimney made on top, made from a human skull. Come on, Robin, let's take a little walk, tell me. Who do you love?
Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love?
Yeah, most people probably know the George Thorogood version of this, but man, Ronnie does a ripped up version. I'm cool with that.
Yeah, he's a wild character.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. You know, when Robbie got...
He's still alive.
Yeah,
he's like 83 years old, but he's still out
there. Good for
him. Yeah.
He didn't go down the wrong path.
No.
No. Levon Helm was in the band when
already.
Robbie hooked
okay.
up with them. So Ronnie and Levon were both from Arkansas and, you know, the Mississippi Delta. And Robbie was just thrilled to be down in the South because that was the place. It was
where the genesis of all that music.
Yeah,
right?
He said it was like rockabilly boot camp, you know, and then Johnny Cash came from there, B.B. King, Elvis Presley, Muddy Waters, Bo Diddley, Sonny Boy Williamson, Robert Johnson, they all came from the Delta area, and he loved that music. So he was just like soaking it up. He was still 16 and touring around with Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks, by the way, he got the gig. And
let's hope so.
Yeah, they were in these clubs and he's only 16 and they realized, you know, Ronnie had to kind of keep him sheltered and keep him kind of out of the way or they would have been busted for having an underage kid, in the bars. So they were, you know, a real, really interesting band for Robbie to hang out with. And Levon was a great teacher and was like a big brother to him and taught him all the arrangements and, you know, played various instruments besides the drums, too. One of the fun things that happened was, they played both in the South and in Southern Ontario, which is kind of an interesting tour circuit. But at one point they were playing, I think it was in Toronto, they were playing across the street from Bo Diddley and they, you know, hung out. Like Robbie went to see Bo Diddley play and then Bo Diddley came back to his room and played for him. And he was just entranced by Bo Diddley and watching him play and incorporated, you know, lifting some of his licks to incorporate into the Hawks and really grooving on Bo Diddley's incredible looking square body guitar, custom built by Gretsch.
That made a big impression
on our young Robbie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the interesting thing is that Robbie started out playing bass for the Hawks and then was graduated to rhythm guitar and then finally made it to lead guitar. So he wasn't the, you know, guitar gunslinger from the very beginning, but he was the youngest and whitest blues boy around at that time in 1961.
Well, let's play a little of Bo Diddley that Robbie kind of lifted some of those licks from. I'm going to play Pretty Thing.
You pretty thing, let me buy you wedding ring. Let me hear the choir sing. Oh, you pretty thing.
All right, so yeah, so I can hear some of Robbie's rhythmic playing there, definitely. So now the Hawks.
Yeah.
Okay, the Hawks become the band. And you mentioned Levon Helm, of course. And I think Robbie and Levon were kind of like the two primary pillars of what became the band. But the other guys are just as instrumental and maybe less well known. And let's see, that's Rick Danko on bass, Richard Manuel on piano.
Keyboards,
And then Garth
what's Garth's
Hudson.
Garth Hudson, right? Garth Hudson on
saxophones and piano and organ.
And organ, right, right.
You know, the interesting thing is they all played eventually many different instruments and kind of switched it up, which you don't see in concert too much. But, you know, on their recordings, they're all kind of moving around and taking different instruments.
Yeah, they do. Does he talk about the story about Garth and how he joined the band?
Oh, yes. So, you know, they were all, you know, quite young. Of course, that's the way rock and roll is. I mean, they were 18. Rick and Richard were both 18 when they joined. And Garth Hudson was a classically trained musician. And Ronnie had to go to his parents and talk him into letting him be in a rock and roll band, because they were like, why would we want him to do that? We've spent all this money sending him to school to train him to be, you know, a music teacher or
there's no future in rock and roll.
Play in a symphony or something like that. Uh-huh. So what Ronnie did to talk him into it was that he would also be the music, kind of like the staff, the band music teacher.
Yeah, and they had to pay him, right?
Yeah, and each member of the band had to pay him $10 a week for music lessons.
Yeah.
Which is a funny story.
That's
and,
awesome.
You know, and Ronnie Hawkins, as Robbie describes him, he wasn't just a band leader. He was, and a lead singer, he was actually kind of like a talent scout. He was always on the lookout for really young, incredibly, you know, talented people to add to his band. And in a way, it kind of, you know, worked against him in the end, but we'll get to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Musicians that were above and beyond his capabilities, I think, is where that went. So,
and like I said, you know, they played in Southern Ontario a lot. And by this time, you know, all those other guys, they were Canadian as well. Mm-hmm. So now we've got, what, four Canadians and two Arkansas guys when they played
Arkansasians?
In Arkansasians, I don't know. When they played in Toronto, the interesting thing was that Robbie's, you know, family, he had a very interesting family, because like I alluded to before, his father ended up not being his birth father.
Oh,
and
really?
His parents separated when he was a teenager and divorced because his dad, Jim, started drinking a lot and was, you know, kind of violent with his mother. And so she divorced him. And then when that was going on, she said, you know, he's not your real father, which was a big surprise, of course, to Robbie.
Yeah.
And she explained that Robbie's father was actually a Jewish man who she, you know, had a relationship with when Jim was off in the military. But Alex was his dad's name. Was killed in a car accident before Jim came home, and Dolly was pregnant already. So Jim married Dolly. They had this baby, and Robbie learned that his father was this kind of well-off Jewish man attached to a very nice Jewish family, except for that they were kind of involved in the underworld and smuggling stolen diamonds. So it was, you know, kind of an interesting family to be reunited with. But when he played in Ontario, you know, he had his Indian uncles and cousins and aunts come, and his Jewish family with his uncles that he got quite close to, and his mother Dolly, and his father, his, you know, adoptive father Jim, who, you know, was still in his life. So so the rest of the guys were like always scratching their heads, like, what's going on here? Who are all these people? You know, how are they related to you? So that was kind of an interesting part of the book.
That's quite a background.
Yeah. Who knew?
All right. So let's get me to becoming the band.
Yes. Well, actually, they didn't become the band until quite a bit later. They left Ronnie Hawkins at a certain point. They kind of, you know, outgrew him, I suppose. And he, you know, wasn't really singing with them. He had gotten married and wasn't really singing with them much anymore. And so they decided to
do their own thing.
Him and become Levon and the Hawks, which morphed into the lovely name of the Canadian Squires, which reminds me of the Pendletones, which was what Beach Boys were first.
Right.
And then they went to New York City to do some recordings. And when they were in New York City, Robbie met John Hammond Jr., who was a blues artist and important in the music business.
Yeah, whose father, the Talent Scout's Talent Scout.
Right.
Yeah, Columbia, yeah.
So they, when they were in New York City, they took John Hammond and said, "Hey, Robbie, you want to go? Let's hang out and let's go see this friend of mine who's recording, you know, an album." And they dropped by the studio, and there was Bob Dylan, who had just recorded Like a Rolling Stone and wanted to play it back for them. So he listened to the song and was, of course, really impressed. It was like nothing he'd ever heard before.
Oh, that old song?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Let's play a little bit of Like a Rolling Stone. So that's how Robbie met Bob Dylan. And of course, Robbie and the band become very entwined with Bob Dylan for the next several years.
That's right. Robbie describes Dylan as a lightning bolt. He was, you know, had a lot of energy and a lot of, you know, just charisma and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Bob told Robbie about playing at the Newport Folk Festival with the Butterfield Blues Band, of which Mike Bloomfield was one of the members. And actually, Mike Bloomfield plays on Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah. And a lot, Al Cooper, too.
Yeah. So Bob wanted to hang out with Robbie, and they kind of played around, you know, they jammed a little bit together. And it turned out that Bob offered Robbie a job.
Oh.
It was just two concerts.
Just Robbie himself?
Yeah. He just wanted Robbie to play and be his lead guitarist because Bloomfield wasn't interested. He just wanted to play the blues.
That was his passion.
Robbie said he wouldn't do it without at least Levon. So they went off and did these two gigs. And I don't know if people know about the, you know, Bob's going electric at the Newport Folk Festival, which he told Robbie it didn't go very well, which was kind of an understatement. You know, people hated it and they booed and all that stuff. But what Bob said before he and Levon went on with him, he said, "Just remember tonight, don't stop playing no matter what." And, you know, they didn't really understand what he meant. So they went in, they hit the stage, they plugged in, and the audience unleashed its fury. Bob's old folk fans, of course, hated hearing the electric versions that Bob Dylan was doing of his music. But Robbie realized that was kind of just a game, like that people realized, oh, when you go to a Dylan concert and he's playing electric, the cool thing to do is boo. So Robbie decided it didn't bother him. They weren't listening, you know, they weren't really commenting on his performance. It was just kind of, that's part of the show, you know, is booing. So, you know, Dylan liked the experience and he decided he wanted them to come along for the entire tour. So Robbie said that they would do it if the Hawks, all of the Hawks, could come along and be the backing band. And
very cool.
That was what happened.
And there you go. And that's
right.
How the band becomes the band
that
for Bob Dylan.
Bob's
it becomes
band.
Bob's band.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Well, let's play a little cut from Bob Dylan. I think Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat.
Good one.
Yes, sir. See, you got your
That's a cool song.
I always loved that song. That's actually from Blonde on Blonde,
right,
which is a Bob Dylan album that Robbie was invited to go to Nashville and record on. And he had a really great time playing on that song. And he said that it was hard to concentrate on playing it because the whole time the band, the other musicians were hearing these outrageous words Bob was belting out, and they had a hard time not laughing while they were playing. But, you know, in the meantime, they were on this tour. They stopped over in New York City for a little while to rest, and Levon Helm decided that he just
done,
couldn't
huh?
take it anymore.
Yeah,
Robbie and Bob were getting closer, and Bob was taking Robbie all around New York City and kind of introducing him to people, and Robbie was just, you know, kind of exhilarated and having a great time, and
falling into the rock star life.
Yeah, and Levon and he were growing farther apart. So Levon just said, I don't, he didn't want to really want to do it in the first place. You know, we got out of one other.
He went and became a farmer or something like that, right?
He worked on an oil rig.
An oil
actually,
rig, that's
yeah.
right, that's right. Yeah.
And he was gone for quite, you know, a
like
couple
two
years.
2 years, I think.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So they had to do without him for a while. They got another. If you see some video of that tour, you'll see a different drummer on it. So anyway, they're touring. Their last show on the Dylan tour, they end up in London, and the Beatles come by and kind of hang out with them for a while in their hotel room, which was pretty thrilling, and their new album for Bob, which was Revolver, and joked about, you know, how the girls were screaming for the Beatles, and Bob said, oh yeah, the girls and boys are screaming at what we're doing, but not in the same way as
right.
for you, you know. So yeah. it was kind of a funny story. They actually, the Beatles kind of come in and out of his life a few different times in the book, so it's impossible to even go through.
I think if you're in that stratosphere hanging out with Bob Dylan,
the
Beatles come and go as time goes on. They come and go pretty much about anything with rock and roll, from certainly from 64 to 70. So
that's right.
Yeah.
While he was in New York City, also he met somebody else that we've had that you've featured on your podcast. His name is Jimmy James.
Jimmy James. I think most people know him by Jimi Hendrix.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. And
right.
they met up, and he has interesting stories about them talking about, you know, guitar playing and songwriting, and how Jimmy tuned his or strung his guitar up so that it didn't go out of tune when he used his
the whammy bar. Right.
Bar. Yep. Yeah. So, you know, it was really fun to read about, you know, these two icons, you know, just kind of being young and getting together and chatting and talking about guitar playing.
Well, yeah. Let's play a little Jimi Hendrix then. What do you think?
Oh, I'd love to hear Jimi Hendrix.
All right, I'm going to play something deep. So we'll do Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window.
Now he sits in your room. He's too. Full of tabs, like he's preoccupied with his vengeance. He's cursing the dead that can't answer him back. You know good well he has no intention of looking your way, unless it's to say that he needs you to test his intention.
There's Jimmy doing Dylan again.
he was kind of drawn to Dylan compositions, wasn't he?
Yeah. He did damn fine with them, didn't he?
Yeah, he sure did.
Yeah, Jimmy's
different.
Another one, kind of like the Beatles. You know, he's one of those guys that just, you know, anybody was anybody. He was in the stratosphere. You know,
yeah.
Beatles and Jimmy or Bob. Those are the three. You know, that's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost right there. when it comes to rock and roll. Yeah. So now they end up in Woodstock. And,
yep.
And this is where, I guess, you know, the Hawks and the Canadian Squires really become what we know as the band.
This
right?
is true. Yep.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it basically started with Dylan's motorcycle accident. He went to...
There's a lot of things that start with Dylan's motorcycle accident.
Yeah, right. So. He went up to Woodstock to convalesce and was living there with his... I believe he was married already to Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
So meanwhile, you know, the tour was over and the Hawks are looking for a place to rehearse and to actually finally get down to their own music and their own sound, because now they've been a backing band for several years. So Sally Grossman, who was Albert Grossman's wife, who was
Bob Dylan's manager
mm-hmm. said, hey, you know, you should look around in Woodstock. You know, the houses are cheap and you could probably get something going up there. So they went up there and they went house hunting and they found this horrible looking, or, you know, this funny looking house, which was a pink ranch style house in the middle of 100 acres of original mountains, a good sized pond, and nothing but space and wilderness all around. But the most important feature was the basement, which they turned into their studio. And Garth Hudson, actually, I don't know if everybody knows this, but he was quite an electronics and kind of like an experimenter and inventor. And so he was taking all, you know, helping set up the studio, putting rugs down, but also rewiring things and, you know, plugging certain instruments through, you know, organs. And I mean, just doing all kinds of stuff that I didn't understand. But that really became their clubhouse and their workshop. And Dylan got involved because he wasn't touring, you know, he was still getting better. And he would come by, they would go there every day.
Yeah, this is the basement tapes come out
of
this.
Yeah, and just play, like, no genre of music was off limits. They would just trade instruments and play, and Dylan had his typewriter there and just spewed out lyrics after lyrics after lyrics. They were just amazed, and taught them all these beautiful old, you know, folk songs that he also had memorized the lyrics to. They couldn't believe how many words that man had in his head that he could kind of sing out on command. And you know,
he's kind of known for that.
Yeah. And they all wrote the songs together. You know, they, like, Dylan would have the words and then he would hand, for example, Tears of Rage to Richard Manuel, who would put some beautiful chord. He's the one that wrote the music to that song, Tears of Rage, which is just an incredible song. I love that song. You know, as Robbie said, songs poured out of Bob and we tore through them. Meanwhile, they knew they had to get Levon back because he was their drummer, and they asked him to come back, and he did. So he joined them
after
in
2 years
Woodstock.
On the oil rig.
Yeah, he was done with that. Wanted to play music again. He'd been playing around, you know, in the Delta area with people, but he, you know, they needed to be together, and he was happy to be asked to come back. And there they all were. And like Robbie said, a lot of the songs they were composing at that time, which is something that I was really drawn to as a teenager, was that they weren't songs that reflected their own lifestyle or even the times they were living in. They were really just trying to write interesting songs. It was a means of storytelling. It was like kind of a Tin Pan Alley tradition. Like, let's just write some songs. They didn't, you know, like, let's write a good story and put some music to it. So, it, you know, it was all kind of, I don't know, like old fashioned and otherworldly, and with this rock and roll mixed in. It was just kind of a magical type of music that didn't fit in anywhere, really.
And that became music from Big Pink.
That did become music from Big Pink. And they ended up calling themselves The Band right before they released that album, because they didn't want to be the Hawks.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of a war-related term in those days. And, you know, everybody in Woodstock was calling them The Band anyway, because they were, at that time, they were the only band in the neighborhood. Now, the thing I didn't understand was when they were recording and writing all of these songs, a lot of them that Dylan was writing, he was writing for other people. And so they were basically recording demos of Bob Bob's songs so that the production companies could offer them out to other recording artists. So they had the Basement Tapes, Dylan songs, and then they had the songs that they were working up for their own record.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to play the most famous song from that, which is a great story song because it starts off at Nazareth, Pennsylvania, which is the home of C.F. Martin guitars.
Ah.
It's called The Wait.
I pulled into Nazareth just a feeling by half past dead. I just need to find a place. Shook my hand.
Yeah, that's an amazing song. And
wow. Yeah, very iconic.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows that song.
That's been covered so many times.
And he should be, yes.
You know, he was really influenced by, he read a lot of movie scripts, like classic movie scripts, and they gave him a lot of ideas for his songwriting. And you can kind of tell in that song, you know, this story is coming. It's a full-blown story nobody quite understands, but it has so much depth and so many characters in it. Mm-hmm. It is like a movie script. And he was still teaching them that they actually had to go, they didn't record these songs for that album at the Big Pink. They had to go into New York City and, you know, into a studio and do it. And he was still teaching them all of their parts, you know, while they were in the recording studio. And it just, they did two takes and it all came together like that with all the staggered singing parts and
yeah, because that's not easy.
No, it's a complicated song, and they didn't ever work from charts. Even they just had lyrics written down and followed the lyrics. And
well, that's
somehow
a band that's been playing with each other for 10 years.
Yeah, right, you know? Right. Yeah, that's really an amazing accomplishment. They basically, you know, they did that album and it came out. And after that, really, they couldn't live in the Big Pink anymore because the picture was on the cover of the album, and they were still trying to fly under the radar. They didn't really want to be to have a lot of public attention, so they...
Well, that works for and against them in a lot of ways. I mean, they're a hugely influential band, and I think they could have been bigger than they were. You know, it's not until later on, you know, they get the accolades that they deserve because they are so influential. But, you know, because they were unwilling to do the star-making machinery that's required, you know, they didn't become, you know, something like the Eagles or CSNY or something like that, which, you know, they had the chops. They definitely had the band to do that, you know, but, you know, that's life, and that's how they chose for it to be. So there's nothing wrong with that.
I don't really think they wanted that. They kind of purposely, you know, didn't want their faces so much on the albums. They didn't want to really do magazine interviews and covers and stuff like that.
Yeah, they were unwilling to play the game that's required to get the audience that would have made them just, you know, huge at the moment.
Right.
I mean, they're legends, so you still win, but there's a lot of sadness that comes with this band too in the long
run.
Part
of the problem was, well, when they were recording the Big Pink, they had apparently a pretty drug-free environment. They, you know, they smoked weed and drank some beers and stuff like that, but for some reason, after the album came out, they just let loose. Not so much Robbie or Garth, but Richard, Rick, and Levon just got into alcohol, prescription pills. They wrecked a bunch of cars. They just, you know, really, I guess they couldn't handle the, I don't know, if it was stardom.
Life on the road, you know, it's mostly filled with boredom. You know, you're on the bus, you move from town to town, especially in those days, you know, you have that moment of 2 or 3 hours on stage and, you know, and then you just do it all over again.
You got to wind up and then you got to wind down.
And then at that time, you know, drugs started to become a big part of the scene. scene and was readily available.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so it's not surprising that some of them came into it. So after Big Pink, they really are the band on their own. They're not attached to Bob Dylan anymore. Right. They've gone and done their thing. And then in 69, I think they come out with their second album, which is called The Band, right?
Yep. It's called The Band, or it's also known as The Brown Album, which I did not know.
Yeah, that's because of the sepia-toned photograph on the brown background, and there's a couple of great songs that come off of that as well.
Well,
so, I mean, several great songs. Now it's starting to get to be, I don't know what to play.
I know.
You know, so, you know, I guess I might go with the one most people know, and I'll leave a few others because I know we're going to get to the last waltz. I'm going to choose The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down because I love that song.
You can't go wrong with that one.
Right.
Yep.
A good old Dan is a name, and I served on the Danville train to Stoneman's Cavalry King and tore up the tracks again in the winter of 65. We were hungry.
Take you back to the Civil War there, huh?
Yeah. The funny thing is that was, well, of course, inspired by Levon's daddy in Arkansas, who said, was known to say, the South is going to rise again. So Robbie wanted to write lyrics about Civil War Southern family's point of view and had to go to the library to read about it because they don't teach that in Canadian schools. So, it's kind of funny because we all know about the Civil War. But
that's a debatable point of view.
Anyway, he told that story when he came and talked to the American Library Association conference a couple years
ago. That's right.
Because we loved that.
Right.
We librarians love to hear that people go to the library to research things.
Right.
But the only thing Levon said was, now don't mention Abraham Lincoln in the lyrics. That won't go down too well.
No, it never does.
No.
The South would like to forget him.
Yeah. So, the other guys kind of stopped taking so much being so involved in writing the music. They got kind of more, involved in partying and stuff. So Robbie took on more and more of the songwriting, responsibilities for the band, which was, what he wanted to do.
Right.
But
right.
He kind of thought of the songs that he was writing about, like, who am I writing this song for and who could sing it really well? And all the Richard and Rick and Levon all had very good and individual and unique voices that he could pair up with his songs.
They each brought a real characterization to their voice.
I always loved their harmonies and how they passed the vocals around. And I was a huge Band fan when I was a teenager, which was a little bit after the fact, but for some reason I was very attracted to their music and all their albums.
They're kind of rootsy in a lot of ways, and in some ways they are kind of rootsy before rootsy was rootsy.
You would almost call them Americana, except that they were mostly Canadian.
North Americana.
Northern Americana.
So the Brown Album comes out in 69, and they're in Woodstock. They recorded Big Pink there, and then, of course, the infamous or famous, your choice, the Woodstock Festival occurs. And I think a lot of people don't know is that they were on the bill, right?
They were. And actually, that was one of the reasons that they held the festival and called it Woodstock, even though it was
Bob was stuck there.
There was
rehabilitating that broken leg.
Because the band and Dylan were living in Woodstock and they were, big at the time. And actually,
I always wondered about
the concert was was not in Woodstock because they didn't have room for it, but they wanted to call it Woodstock anyway.
Yeah, Yasgur's Farm.
Yeah, Bethel, New
right.
York.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they agreed to do it, and they were told, oh, since, you know, this whole thing is kind of named after you and your town, you can close the show on the third night, which, okay, if you say so. They had to be flown in by helicopter because it was so huge by that time.
Oh, yes.
And then they were told that Jimi Hendrix arrived and he wanted to close, which was fine with the band because it was getting later and later and later. And they were just really overwhelmed by the whole experience. And Jimmy, you know, met up with Robbie and said, hey, you know, I just wanted you to know that wasn't an ego trip. I just, you know, was told I could play whenever I wanted. And that's when I want to play. And Robbie's like, hey, it's cool.
Great. You can have Monday morning.
Yeah. You know, they,
with the trash,
the band didn't get out there till fly out on the helicopter until 1 a.m. And there was this feeling like anything could have gone wrong at any moment, but for some reason it worked out.
Yeah, it all worked.
But after that, they weren't very welcome in the town of Woodstock because they were blamed for this crazy hippie crap coming on top of the town.
Well, I'll play again from the band, the Brown album, Up on Cripple Creek, because maybe they were up on Cripple Creek. Huh?
That's right. You can't not play that.
Right.
When I get off of this mountain, you know where I want to go. Straight down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, so I don't think they make it in the movie either. I think they're cut.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think I saw a little clip of them.
Are they?
At Woodstock, but maybe not.
I haven't seen that movie in ages.
Anyway, well, around that time, one of the things that was happening that was really kind of disrupting their connection as a band was that Levon, Richard, and Rick started playing around with heroin.
Oh, yeah.
And that just kind
of people did right
made it
that.
Difficult. Robbie is sitting there trying to get them to write with him and to practice and to play, and they just were not, you know, accessible. And he realized that they were such a democratic band that this was a real problem because, you know, they all needed to be functioning for their magic to happen. And it just wasn't, he couldn't rely on it. You know, he didn't know when they were going to all be there or not. But they did do, you know, several more albums through
this.
Oh,
yeah, they were pretty prolific here through the 70s.
Yeah, their next one was Stage Fright.
Yeah.
By that time, writing was getting a little bit painful for Robbie because of not having his pals to, you know, collaborate with him. And some of the songs that are on that album reflect what he was feeling about his bandmates at that time. For example, The Shape I'm In, he wrote for Richard, which is, you know, oh, you don't know the shape I'm in. He was not in good shape. And Stage Fright, he wrote for Rick, and the W.S. Walcott Medicine Show for Levon. And they were all kind of undertones of madness and self-destruction in that period of time and in those songs that he was writing.
Well, let's take a moment, and this is from 1970, Stage Fright. Let's play Stage Fright.
Now, deep in the heart of a lonely kid, suffered so much for what he did. They gave this poor boy his fortune and fame. Since that standing up there to give it all his might, he got caught in the spotlight. But when they get to the end, it was a start all over again. Wow.
changed my mind. I played all three of them. I mean, pieces of them. So yeah. It's so hard to pick with these guys. We only got about an hour show, folks. Yeah, so, I know. You know, and it just goes to show just how great these guys were, you know, to make it so difficult to find the songs that kind of tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
So many do. And, you know, there are three songs written for three of the members of the band that are going through tough times. So, and then we kind of run through several other songs from 71 to 75. Anything particular really you want to touch on?
Well, I wanted to mention that in the album Cahoots and also on the live album, which is called Rock of Ages, yeah. So those are 71, yeah. 72, mm-hmm. Our old friend Alan Toussaint, the New Orleans piano player, producer, singer, band leader, scored the horn parts for a lot of the songs on both those albums, and he actually scored the live show, Rock of Ages live show, which was quite an interesting story of him coming up to record with them and help them out and losing his charts on the airplane and then having to score them all over again from scratch. And just, he's just an amazing, he's a total genius with scoring and producing. So one of the songs from actually both of those albums that really show the horn parts is Life is a Carnival, which grew out of Robbie's time. He worked at a ragtime carnival when he was a teenager in Toronto. And actually all the guys...
I did that for a while.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Wow.
I used to do some of the games and then trade the mirrors, if you remember back in
the... You had a nice loud voice for getting all those all those people in to waste their money.
Yes, and it was a great waste of money.
Yes.
All right, let's play a little of Carnival. And just so you know, I picked all three songs from Rock of Ages, Shape I'm In, Stage Fright, and W.S. Walcott. Yeah.
And walk on the water.
Fun.
Yeah. Yeah. That New Orleans kind of sound comes across in some of those songs on that album.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The next album they did was an album just of covers called Moondog Matinee.
Yes. Yeah.
One of the reasons was that because some of the band members were, you know, kind of inaccessible and unavailable, they weren't coming up with any new material. And they just thought, let's just try to get back to having some fun with each other.
Uh-huh.
And so they play, you know, they chose all of these great songs. It's a great album. And they, of course, their covers are like nobody else's covers. So,
well, and I'll tell you, I'm trying to play as much live music because they're such a great live band. So it's not surprising they'd go back and do a covers album with their own unique spin on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Mystery Train, Robbie even wrote some additional words for it. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I think they got one more album before they get to The Last Waltz here. And I know they have one album that they do afterwards in 77. I think they were done by then.
Right. Well, so, one of the things that happened was they all moved to Malibu, which was kind of a big change from Woodstock. They met David
Let's
Geffen.
Let's see. We're on drugs. Let's move to L.A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things didn't get any better in L.A. But, you know, they went on tour with Dylan again. That was an interesting thing in 1974.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm.
I actually saw that tour. That was one of my first concerts at the L.A. Forum.
Uh-huh.
And just loved the band more than Dylan. I just just was like blown sky high by their performance and all their harmonies and everything. I even wrote about it in my American Literature Journal the next day.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll have to get a copy of that and put it up on Facebook.
Yeah, I'm not sure I still have it. And they released an album of the Basement Tapes, which was some of the some of the recordings they'd done from when they were in the Big Pink. They had to fix them up a little bit, but they realized there were so many bootlegs going around, they might as well do their own. And then they did an album called Northern Lights, Southern Cross. Robbie started writing again, and he, one of the best songs off that album, I think, is Ophelia, which is
Jesus, yes.
amazing and perfect for Leave On, and, you know, a kind of a modern day Shakespearean story is the way he talks about it. That's his favorite track on that album. Pure jubilant pleasure.
That's what we're going to play. Ladies and gentlemen, Ophelia. And you know what? I actually played that version from The Last Waltz. That's the official end of the band. And I believe that's the end of the book, too, right?
Yep. He ends the book at the end of The Last Waltz. You know, a few more comments. But yeah, that's where he decided to stop.
Wow. That's kind of interesting because there's a lot of shit that goes on afterwards.
Yep.
I know Levon talked a little bit about it in his biography.
Right.
But it ends on The Last Waltz. Let's talk about The Last Waltz. Kind of an important concert, huh?
Definitely. You know, one of the things that propelled them that way and to do a Last Waltz was them all realizing that, you know, being on the road and kind of getting caught up in this crazy lifestyle, you know, there were so many destructive influences and at least a few, you know, like Robbie says, they weren't any of them angels. I mean, he and Garth did drugs too, but it was the other three guys that really got more, you know, more involved in it. You know, they all had horrible injuries for one reason or another. And this year, 1976, Richard fell off the back of a speedboat while they were on their way to a festival and snapped his neck, and also was still really, really heavily into drugs and heroin and alcohol.
Maybe that's why he fell off a speedboat.
It could be. And Robbie had started to think about, you know, maybe they should get off the road before something really bad happened.
Right.
You know, he wanted to help Richard and they all wanted to help Richard, but they didn't know about things like rehab and all that stuff.
Oh, no, there wasn't a lot of that.
No.
Around at that
and
time.
They'd been touring for 15 or 16 years and it was becoming a painful chore.
Yeah.
So they got this idea, you know, they were all on board for it. They needed to kind of go out with a bang and start to rest and get back to productivity. So I don't think it was kind of considered like this was going to be the end of the band, but that this was going to be the last live show that they were going to do, kind of like the Beatles and the Beach Boys, or at least Brian Wilson decided.
It kind of ended up being the end of the band.
Yep.
Yeah.
So they got together with, of course, Bill Graham and Martin Scorsese and had this idea of having it filmed. They chose, first they were just going to have Ronnie Hawkins and Bob Dylan be their guests because they were so important in the germination of their sound and everything. But then they just kind of kept adding people and they had this idea that they wanted their guests to represent different kinds of music.
Mm-hmm.
So they got Eric Clapton for the British blues, Dr. John for New Orleans, Joni Mitchell for female songwriters, Canadian songwriters, Muddy Waters for the Chicago blues, Paul Butterfield as the harmonica master, Neil Diamond for that kind of
Tin Pan Alley
tradition.
Right.
They actually, he and Robbie worked on some stuff together. And Van Morrison for Irish R&B, Neil Young for Canada. And then later on, after the concert was over, he realized they hadn't included gospel and country. So they recorded
the Staples and Emmylou Harris.
Right. Afterwards, and incorporated that into the music. Mm-hmm. So into the movie and the album. So.
Do you know, we're working on a Bill Graham episode right now, mm-hmm. and one of the things that we discovered was that, unlike Bill, there was no mention of the guests before the show. It was the band, and the band was going to play,
right?
And there might be some guests,
right?
But you didn't know who it was,
right?
And then
I know.
You got this giant set of these great artists all at the same time. It's really amazing, and it's just the way it's filmed is beautiful. It's just really I can watch that that movie over and over again. No problem.
Yeah, it was really special. I mean, they had there was a little tension between Bill Graham and Martin Scorsese because.
Really? I can't imagine that.
Because
two New Yorkers screaming at each other. Plus, who would know?
They had different goals. You know, Bill Graham was about the audience and
the
music, and Martin was setting up cameras all over the place. And Bill was like, "How are people supposed to see with that camera there?" And it was a huge, so many balls in the air. It was kind of amazing that it really, came off the way it did.
Mm-hmm.
And they flew into San Francisco, and Robbie was still writing music both in the hotel and during the the beginning of when the people came in and they were having their Thanksgiving dinner with tables and tablecloths and waltzing and all that stuff.
Oh yeah, there's all kinds of things that goes on.
Robbie was still working on his song Evangeline, and
Lawrence Ferlinghetti comes in, Ferlinghetti from City Lights, and does a poem and all.
They had scenery from the San Francisco Opera and
chandeliers are nice.
Yeah.
It's how the last concert I want to have.
Right.
Put it that way.
Too bad I was too young and stupid to know I should have gone.
All right. So let's see. We got to play a song, and we're only going to get one song to play from the last waltz.
Oh, it's so hard
so
to choose.
I can't pick it. You're going to have to pick it.
Oh, dear. Just one?
Just one.
Oh, my God. I think I kind of like the Caravan with Van Morrison.
Van the Man.
And he, as Robbie said, he tried on some outfit before the concert. And when it was time, he came on in this, what he called, kind of like an acrobat's outfit, red kind of track pants.
Yep.
And he couldn't figure out why is Van wearing that until the end of the song. He realized Van was kicking his legs up really high and punching the air and kind of doing this really very physical performance.
Yeah.
And it's just electric.
It is. It's one of my favorites from that show. So, although, boy, there are a lot. But let's end with a little bit of Caravan here. So here you go, folks. Yeah, that'll do it. Man, it's just, Bob Dylan's Carry Me Down is great. Neil Young.
Heartless.
Help us.
Yeah, with Joni Mitchell backing him up.
Offstage.
Yeah. They didn't want to announce her before it was her turn to come on.
Yeah,
and the audience was all like, where is that ethereal, magical, angelic voice coming from?
And of course, Ronnie Hawkins is there, Muddy Waters, Eric Clapton. It's awesome.
Ringo and Ronnie Wood came out at the end to play with them, to jam.
Yeah, yeah.
For the band that didn't jam, they had some jam sessions at the end.
So what do you think of the book? It's kind of weird. It ends right here, but maybe there's a volume 2 coming, huh?
It could be, though. I saw him on his book tour
talking, and he didn't mention
a sequel, but it seems like there should be. Yeah, there was basically it ends like they, you know, it was great and they all looked at each other and they had this great moment and realized they didn't done a great job. Everybody, you know, showed up and, you know, did their part. Richard was in good form and, you know, nobody was fucked up and, you know, screwed up. And, you know, it was an amazing way to end it. But the end of the book is kind of sad because you can tell, you know, well, you know that they don't stay together, but that wasn't the plan for The Last Waltz, that they were going to break up. And Robbie, you know, talks about getting together to start recording the new album and nobody shows up. That's kind of the way it ends.
That's Island, right?
Yeah, I think he said he knew that they would fulfill their last responsibilities and commitments. So I'm assuming he means that they owed one more record on their contract and they did that record. But he doesn't really talk about what happened after The Last Waltz. But he does give very beautiful kind of odes to each band member at the end of the book where, you know, you really feel like he's not nitpicking at people. I know there were some things that happened afterwards that were, you know, there was some court cases about publishing rights and stuff like that. But he really shows that he totally respects, admires, and, you know, and just loves each member of that band and what they all contributed to the sound that they made.
Right. Right. And well, it definitely was a unique moment in rock and roll history. It really is a great group and worthy of the name, the band.
That's right.
So let's leave it at that. You think the book is great?
I do.
I don't think you read a bad one. I mean, pretty much can.
When I start them, if they're not good, I don't finish them.
There you go, folks.
Yeah, so they've got to be good. And you've got to read the book, everybody. There's so many great stories in this book. It's hard to have talked about it in an hour.
Right, right. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Diggers, the Rock and Roll Librarian, has read Testimony for you, suggests that you go out and get it. We'll have another Rock and Roll Library coming up next month. Until then, hey, keep up the rockin'.
Keep it up.
Looking for ways to help right the wrongs of social injustice? Oxfam America works with people in more than 90 countries to save lives, develop long-term solutions to poverty, and campaign for social change. And we do it with the help of our friends in the music world. The Beatles were Oxfam supporters back in the day. So were the Stones. And through the years, musicians and music fans have helped Oxfam push hard to work for a just world without poverty. Folks like Radiohead, Coldplay, Pearl Jam, DJ Shadow, and many, many more have encouraged their fans to join the effort. You can too. Go to OxfamAmerica.org to learn how you can help.
The Rock and Roll Librarian, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. Co-host, Shelley Sorensen. All sound design and incidental music by Jerry Danielson. All quotes performed by actors unless noted. Playlists can be found at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Please purchase these great and important tracks. All songs, clips, and references can be found on our show notes. Please visit rnrap.com for more information.